This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, February 23, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Human rights groups denounce the Justice Department's indictment of Ahmed Abu Ali. India cuts military aid to Nepal 3 weeks after the Nepalese king imposed military rule. And in New Hampshire, a community resists the construction of a third Walmart in their city. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. On day three of President Bush's European tour, more than 7,000 protesters braved freezing conditions in the West German city of Mainz to demonstrate against the war in Iraq and U.S. foreign policy. Guy Deegan reports from Bonn.
The German city of Mainz was virtually sealed off in a massive security clampdown today as President Bush met with German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder at the city's Kurfürstliches Castle. Around 10,000 police were on hand to keep protesters well away from President Bush as part of tight security measures that included closing the River Rhine to shipping, blocking local highways, and suspending air traffic for 35 miles around Mainz. Malte Kreutzfeldt from the German activist collective ATTAC told demonstrators that President Bush is responsible for an illegal war in Iraq, increasing global poverty and eroding civil rights. On the question of Iran and its nuclear program, President Bush sought to ease European worries that the US is planning to use military force in the future. However, he repeated that all options were still on the table. In Bonn, Germany, this is Guy Deegan for Free Speech Radio News.
Three-day peace talks between the Indonesian government and the Free Aceh movement in Helsinki, Finland ended today. The Indonesian Minister of Information says that the GAM delegation accepted a special autonomy status for the gas-rich province. From Jakarta, Maggie Margiono.
Free classes continued in Aceh when the delegation of Indonesian and Free Aceh movement met in Finland. An army member was reportedly killed while 19 others were injured. Indonesian police and army have imposed a curfew in the pro-independent regions. The recent talks made significant progress after more than 30 years of armed conflict that has claimed more than 12,000 lives. The Indonesian Aceh NGO Coalition is supporting the new talks. The coordinator of Aceh Working Group, Ravendi Jamin, said that both sides should reach a commitment to a ceasefire and give attention to the interests of tsunami victims rather than to their own political interests. Both GAM and Indonesian delegations agreed to meet again mid-April. The next talk will give attention on special autonomy status for Aceh. The last peace agreement in 2002 was broken and led to martial law. From Jakarta, Maggie Margiono for Free Speech Radio News.
Federal government employees claim they were shut out of a process to reform the labor relations system of the Department of Defense. Today, a coalition of labor unions announced a lawsuit against the DOD. Jenny Johnson reports from Washington, D.C.
The unions charge that the Department of Defense acted in secrecy to dramatically change the current rules for labor relations, thus violating a law that specifies a collective process for such changes. The unions say the process for determining new rules was undermined by meaningless discussions in which nothing substantive was revealed about the government's intentions in creating new rules. The government published its new rules recently in the Federal Register. Over a year of meetings, Steve Lankart of the National Association of Government Employees says union representatives tried to be cooperative.
Please tell us what you're thinking about changes in the future. We can respond to those changes and work with you to try to achieve something. We got absolutely no response from them. We got nothing more than vague general guidelines of what they want to accomplish in the new system, but no reference to what's specifically wrong with the current system. They gave us nothing to work with.
The lawsuit is an effort to halt the rules that unions are concerned could do away with collective bargaining altogether. Jenny Johnson, Free Speech Radio News.
Mexican legislators voted late yesterday to make a significant reform to the nation's electoral code. Shannon Young has more from Mexico.
Mexican electoral law currently has no provision for absentee voting. A bill passed yesterday in Mexico's lower house of Congress aims to change that. The proposed reform would permit registered voters living abroad to participate in the 2006 presidential election. According to the Secretary of Foreign Relations, almost all Mexicans living outside of national territory reside within the United States. Official estimates put the current number of potential voters at 4 million. The proposal would install voting centers in areas with at least 15,000 Mexican registered voters. The bill would also allow presidential candidates to campaign in the United States, with the condition that all campaign advertising be broadcast on Mexican-owned media outlets that reach the U.S. The bill will now go to the Senate for a vote, where it is expected to pass. For FSRN, this is Shannon Young in Oaxaca.
Two British soldiers have been found guilty at a court-martial of charges relating to abusing Iraqi prisoners at Camp Breadbasket, Basra, during May of 2003. Daniel Kenyon and Mark Cooley face up to 2 years in jail. Cooley was found guilty of two charges, one of disgraceful conduct of a cruel kind after he drove a forklift truck with a bound Iraqi suspended from the prongs. Cooley told the court that he was moving the man out of the sun's glare. Kenyon, the most senior soldier on trial, was convicted of failing to report the actions of a junior soldier. He was also found guilty of failing to report that soldiers under his command had forced two naked prisoners to simulate sex. The military panel will sentence the men on Friday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
Human rights groups and friends of Ahmed Abu Ali denounced the Justice Department's indictment of Abu Ali of conspiracy to assassinate George Bush. Abu Ali, a U.S. citizen, was returned from Saudi Arabia this week, where he had been detained without charge for 2 years. Abu Ali's lawyers contend that evidence used against him was obtained through torturous interrogations. Mitch Jeserich reports from Washington, D.C.
On Monday, Virginia native Ahmed Abu Ali finally came home after being detained and allegedly tortured in Saudi Arabia for the past 2 years. Upon his return, however, the Justice Department indicted Abu Ali on 6 terrorism-related charges, which includes providing material support to Al-Qaeda and plotting to kill George Bush.
The U.S. government was directly involved in violating Ahmed's constitutional and statutory rights by having him held in Saudi Arabia for purposes of interrogation.
Morton Squar is the executive director of the World Organization for Human Rights and the lead attorney in filing a habeas corpus petition on behalf of Abu Ali while he was detained in Saudi Arabia without charge. In December, a federal judge ordered the U.S. government to justify why Abu Ali was being held by Saudi authorities. Squar says he thinks it was this ruling that forced the Justice Department to bring the charges.
And these criminal charges probably are a direct result of the fact that the U.S. government could not get around that decision that the judge required them to come forth with information about the extent of their involvement in Ahmed's illegal arrest and detention in Saudi Arabia. Faced with that embarrassment, the government found it a lot easier to bring him back home and prosecute him. And that's why they did this.
Ahmed Abu Ali was born in Texas and grew up in Virginia. Free Speech Radio News spoke with his sister, Tasmin Abu Ali, last summer when his family and others demonstrated in front of the State Department calling for Abu Ali's return.
Ahmed actually graduated valedictorian of his class here in the U.S. and he went to Saudi Arabia on a full scholarship to study Islamic sciences at Medina University.
How was it that he was apprehended in the first place?
Right. He was taking his final exams, and Saudi police came in and arrested him while he was in the middle of his final exam.
According to the indictment returned by a federal grand jury, Abu Ali is accused of accepting money from Al-Qaeda operatives to buy laptop computers, cell phones, and books. The evidence primarily comes from testimony from unidentified co-conspirators. Appearing in a federal court on Tuesday, Abu Ali did not enter a plea, but he did offer to show the scars on his back that were allegedly caused by the hands of Saudi officials. Abu Ali's case highlights the U.S.'s alleged use of what's known as rendition, in which a prisoner is sent to another country for interrogation where U.S. anti-torture laws don't apply. Jumana Musa with Amnesty International questions whether any statements made by Abu Ali while he was in Saudi Arabia could be admissible in court.
The State Department, Amnesty International, human rights monitors around the world have documented the history of eliciting confessions by torture in Saudi Arabia prisons. So, at this point, to take that information and use it in a court would be very troubling, both because of the unreliable nature of information obtained by torture, but also any information obtained by torture to allow it to enter a courtroom is, in a sense, endorses torture.
If convicted, Abu Ali could face 80 years in jail. Mitch Jezrich, Free Speech Radio News.
The Palestinian Legislative Council postponed its meeting aimed at discussing Prime Minister Ahmed Kurey's new cabinet. Kurey needs the approval of a minimum of 43 of the council's 85 members to support his choices for the new government. On Monday, he managed to get the approval of only 39 members. From Ramallah, Awad Dawabis has more.
PLC Speaker Rouhi Fattouh announced today that Kurey is due to present his new cabinet for a confidence vote tomorrow or Saturday as a final deadline according to Palestinian law. But Ahmed Kurey is having troubles convincing his own Fatah party to support his new cabinet. The Prime Minister is in a difficult position, negotiating demands from the opposition and the civil society to have technocrats capable of and willing to enact presidential reforms, as well as demands from some within Fatah who are asking for their representative quotas. Mustafa Barghouthi, a civil society leader and former candidate to the Palestinian presidential elections, says the main cause of this crisis is Fatah's monopoly of power.
This crisis is related to the fact that Fatah is running the show as if it's the only ruling party in the country. And I believe the only way out of this crisis is to have free elections. But the basic reason why they are failing is because Fatah, as a governing party, has failed to provide a program for reform.
After the rejection of Kurey's cabinet yesterday, a meeting between Kurey and President Mahmoud Abbas with the participation of the leadership of Fatah this morning did not succeed in the approval of a new cabinet formed last night. One source said that after this meeting, Fatah discussed who might replace Ahmed Kurey. The Fatah bloc at the Legislative Council is due to have a meeting late this evening in order to put an end to the crisis. And there has been no confirmation of a possible withdrawal of Ahmed Kurey as the nominated prime minister. According to political analyst Imad Asfar, some members of Fatah are looking for a cabinet that would work to enact the reform program announced by President Abbas.
What we are seeing is a courageous program of reform proposed by the elected president Mahmoud Abbas. The new cabinet is not capable of carrying out this program. That's why I think the change is necessary by forming a government from outside the Legislative Council. This would allow the Legislative Council to supervise and evaluate the work of the government in a better way.
But the old guard within Fatah is holding to the old cabinet. Jawad Tibi, Minister of Health and Deputy at the Legislative Council, insisted that the old cabinet is the right one to approve, since it includes technocrats, including himself.
I think it was very good government. Why to change it now? PLC wasn't trying at all to change it. It was in the presidential addressing. I was chosen from my people and my constituency. I worked with confidence from the parliament. And now someone is talking about technocrat? No, I cannot accept it. I'm a technocrat also.
I am Awad Davis reporting for Free Speech Radio News, Ramallah.
In an unexpected announcement today, Iraqi interim Prime Minister Ayad Alawi said he would, in fact, form a coalition to challenge the Shiite alliance's pick for prime minister. In continuing violence, a car bomb in Iraq's northern city of Mosul killed at least two today, and one U.S. soldier died north of Baghdad when his convoy was hit by a roadside bomb. At least 1,026 U.S. soldiers have been killed by hostile fire since the invasion began nearly 2 years ago. In the capital today, reaction ranged across the spectrum at the announcement by the coalition of Shiite political parties that captured most of last month's vote that they had chosen Ibrahim Jafari, a conservative doctor, as their candidate for prime minister. David Enders files this report from Baghdad.
U.S.-appointed Prime Minister Ayad Alawi, who currently holds the position Jafari has been nominated for, said he would construct a coalition of secular politicians to support him in a bid to retain his post. Alawi's party, the Iraq List, took 40 seats in the country's 275-member National Assembly, while the coalition of which Jafari is a part, the United Iraqi Alliance, took 140 seats. Some Iraqis fear Jafari, who is the leader of Dawah, a conservative Islamic party that was one of the targets of Saddam Hussein's purges, would seek to impose Islamic law on the country. Others worry Jafari might take a harder line against members of the Ba'ath Party, which formerly ruled the country. Alawi recalled many party members, especially teachers, who had been fired from their jobs by U.S. proconsul Paul Bremer. Imad Shahab Ahmed is a former brigadier general in Iraq's Air Force and was a member of the Ba'ath Party.
The officials in the government business was in Ba'ath Party. If you come now and want to remove all these people, that means you will remove about 2 to 3 million of people who are in business. There is no chance to take a job if you don't go inside the Ba'ath Party. And those people, not all of them are bad.
Dawa and the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq are the two main parties on the UIA list. Members of both parties were forced into exile, mainly in Iran, at the beginning of the Iran-Iraq War in 1980, and both have been accused of carrying out assassinations of former Ba'athists since the end of the U.S.-led invasion.
Because the Iranian side pushed them. Because in the Iraq war between Iran and Iraq for 8 years, there are many problems between the two countries. Yani, revenge, I make something. Now they checking all the pilots by names from Hizb al-Da'wah or something. Name by name. They check their home and kill them. Even the Air Force headquarters, Hamid Sha'ban, they go to his home. They want to kill him. And they killed his servant. And he defend himself by a gun or something. So this man and now the last Iraqi headquarters, Air Force commander, they go out to Syria, to Emirates, to Jordan, because they're afraid they kill them.
Ahmed said that he hopes Jafari, if he is confirmed as prime minister, will at least improve the security situation so that the police might stop some of the killings. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
After boycotting the South Asian Association of Regional Cooperation, or SARC, meeting, India has also cancelled its military aid to Nepal in response to the King of Nepal dismissing a democratically elected government. For over 3 weeks now, Nepalese citizens have lived under military rule, with the government regularly censoring media and detaining hundreds of political rivals, activists, and journalists. As the Nepalese monarchy continues its tirade against what it calls high-scale corruption, there are mixed views on India's decision to cut military aid. FSRN's Binu Alex has more.
Yesterday, India joined the US and UK to halt all military supplies to Nepal, thereby putting pressure on the monarchy in the Himalayan kingdom to restore democracy. Right from the start, the Indian government has opposed King Gyanendra's takeover of power, calling for restoration of multi-party democracy and constitutional monarchy. But analysts like Captain Bharat Varma, editor of Indian Defence Review, is of the opinion that the blockade will not help the restoration of power by the people.
I don't think this kind of a pressure can bring back democracy. I personally feel that India must reconsider its stand on military blockade, because India cannot afford to encourage under any circumstances takeover by Maoists. We cannot have another border becoming unstable.
King Gyanendra justified his decision, saying democracy was at grave risk from the Maoist insurgency and the political instability it caused. India had been one of the major arms suppliers for Nepal's army, with more than 70% of this aid coming in the form of grants. India's External Affairs Ministry reiterated that all bilateral relations with Nepal are being reassessed and reviewed. The ministry also urged the monarchy to release all detained political leaders, human rights activists, and journalists. Nepal Today said it will mobilize internal resources to fund military operations against rebels. K. Subramaniam is one of India's top strategic affairs experts. He says India's move is justified.
Well, India was not left with no option. Therefore, if Maoists ought to be tackled, can be done only by using the Nepali army as well as by collaborating with the Nepali political parties. If all the political leaders are all locked up, that creates further tension in Nepal. It is difficult for the king to deal with the Maoists.
Meanwhile, in Nepal, communication lines are back to normal and a transport embargo called by the Maoists continues. The rebels have also ruled out any talks with the king, thereby leaving only a slim chance of avoiding violent confrontations. From Ahmedabad in India, Benu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Walmart's plans to build a new superstore in New Hampshire hit a roadblock Tuesday night. The company wants to fill in neighborhood wetlands to make room for a parking lot for a new store they want to build in the town of Nashua. The town's water supply is obtained through the same wetlands Walmart wants to pave a parking lot over, a move local activists say would put their water in jeopardy. Avishay Artsy has more from Nashua.
Nashua's Zoning Board of Adjustment unanimously rejected Walmart's requests for two zoning variances and an exemption from the city's wetlands ordinance. The global retail giant presented plans to build a 186,000-square-foot superstore. The site is now occupied by Building 19, a New England retail chain. That store is less than half the size of the proposed Walmart. The company wanted permission to fill 3/4 of an acre of wetlands to expand the parking lot. Charles Friu is the moderator of a group called Citizens Action for Southern New Hampshire. He said Walmart should look at building an underground parking lot or a multi-level store instead.
There is no need for Walmart or any other big box store to exceed the footprint of the existing building and parking lot on the site.
Walmart proposed to then build 2 new wetland areas near the store to compensate for the pond they filled in. That pond is connected to the Penichuk Brook watershed. That watershed provides most of the drinking water to Nashua and other surrounding towns. Opponents of the proposal say gasoline and other chemical runoff could pollute the water. Gerald Prunier, a lawyer for Walmart, disagrees.
We have spent approximately 2 years showing the Conservation Commission what we can do with this particular site to avoid any problems with the wetlands, so that when we are finished construction, the water coming off of this site is cleaner than it is at the present time, with less velocity.
But Alan Fuller, chairman of the Penichuk Brook Watershed Council, said that's just not true. He said soluble materials from a leaking gas tank or radiator could pass through the filtration system and into the water supply.
It's really short-sighted on people's part to develop on the watershed and destroy our drinking water supply and then have future generations have to pick up either sourcing water somewhere else or figuring out how to treat the water in a very expensive way.
Nashua's Conservation Commission voted last month in favor of the proposal. The commission serves an advisory role to the zoning board. Catherine Nelson was the commission's chairwoman until her resignation last month following the Walmart vote.
No evidence was presented that I thought reliably could demonstrate that water quality will be improved on the site by the plan that's being proposed by Walmart.
Nelson and another member of the commission received emails after the Walmart vote from Nashua Mayor Bernie Streeter. He informed them they would not be reappointed to their positions. The former commissioners say Streeter wants to stack the commission with pro-business members more willing to support development in wetlands. But Streeter said he had no influence on the commission's decision.
That's an absolute joke. I don't muscle anybody. The Conservation Commission voted, I think it was 4-3, without any communication, consultation, commitment, or conversation with me whatsoever.
Streeter has spoken in favor of the Walmart proposal. He said local officials should not keep the company out just because of its record.
To make it a political issue like that, I think, is wrong. If a company wants to come to Nashua, and they want to abide by the rules and regulations, and they pass environmental muster, then it's not up to government to say, they're unwelcome.
This would be the first Walmart in Nashua, but there are Walmarts in 2 neighboring towns, Hudson and Amherst. The nearest one is 3.8 miles away, on the same road. Local activists say that's more than enough. About 120 Nashua residents packed the City Hall's auditorium. Many wore buttons that read, "Clean Water, Not Walmart." Jocelyn Demuth is a member of Citizens Action for Southern New Hampshire. That group began last year as a network of local volunteers on various presidential campaigns. Recently, it took on the Walmart proposal with a petition drive and a letter-writing campaign to the local newspaper. Demuth said the group has followed the lead of other towns in the United States that successfully kept Walmart out.
I think a lot of us feel, well, we're not fond of Walmart, but we respect the owner's right to lease a building to whom he wants, but not at the expense of the health of the city.
Walmart now has 20 days to appeal the zoning board's decision, and state environmental officials are scheduled to take a look at Walmart's plans late next month. Avishai Artsy, FSRN, Nashua.
The International Olympic Committee is visiting New York City this week to examine the city's capability to host the 2012 Summer Olympics. But for New Yorkers and city officials, the heart of the bid rests around a stadium on the west side. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more.
13 members of the selection commission for the IOC is touring New York City's proposed Olympic site for a 2012 Olympic Games bid that will be decided on July 6 in Singapore. New York's host committee, NYC 2012, has plastered the city with slogans in elementary colors written vertically on a black background that read, "Every flag will wave," or "Every country will have a home team." They are meant to reflect the diversity of New Yorkers, where 60% are immigrants. At the site of the proposed Olympic Village on the waterfront in Queens, residents' opinions are just as diverse as their cultural makeup. Tom Christensen lives blocks away from the proposed site of the Olympic Village. He says that the Olympics will be bad for the community because the housing rates will soar, even if they do turn village housing into low-income and affordable apartments.
And likely, just on a selfish basis, I could very reasonably be pushed out of this neighborhood by the Olympics, and I don't want that.
But shop owner Sung owns a deli just blocks from the proposed village. He's from Seoul and saw how great the 1988 Olympic Games were for South Korea's economy.
Even Korea, there was no expect to the Olympic. And we have in New York City, we have more, you know, more opportunity because we never have Olympic. And we have everything here around modern South Korea.
But at the heart of the Olympic bid is a debate over a stadium on the west side of Manhattan, one of the last undeveloped portions of the island. Mayor Bloomberg, Governor Pataki, and NYC 2012 innovator Deputy Mayor Dan Doktoroff have partnered with the New York Jets football team to build a $2 billion stadium and a $1.5 billion subway extension to reach the far west side. Less than 30% of New Yorkers support the stadium, with the unions making up the largest number of supporters. Organized labor say the stadium could offset high unemployment in the unions, but most New Yorkers don't want their tax dollars spent on a football stadium that will add pollution, congestion, and expensive housing. The property is owned by the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, who is carrying a several hundred million dollar budget deficit. Cablevision in Madison Square Garden offered $600 million for the land. That's $500 million more than the Jets offered. Brian Hatch, former deputy mayor for Salt Lake City, who oversaw that city's Olympic bid, says that a stadium is not necessary to receive the Olympic bid, as three of the last four cities did not have a stadium at that time. He also says the stadium debate is hurting the chances of New York City receiving the bid for two reasons. The stadium is polarizing public opinion, and the cost of the stadium adds to the cost of the games, which is proposed to cost $12 billion. Hatch says the high cost goes against the policy of the IOC to create an equal playing field for all cities.
The five rings on the flag represent, the Olympic flag, represent the five main continents of the world, and yet they've never been to two of those rings. Africa and South America. And if the current pattern continues where the cost of an Olympics leaps by billions every 4 years, they'll never get there. But what NYC 2012 has done is proposed a bid that only the wealthiest cities in the world could ever hope to propose.
But Mayor Bloomberg and Deputy Mayor Doktoroff says the stadium is essential to win the Olympic bid. The IOC is aware of the debate and has asked NYC 2012 about the process that remains, but NYC 2012 assured them that the stadium will be underway by the bid date this summer. Mike Moran is spokesperson for NYC 2012.
We have no backup plan, and we are fully confident that we will have that West Side Stadium nailed down, those plans firm by the time they vote on July 6th. No, there is no backup. There is no plan B.
New York City is competing with London, Madrid, Paris, and Moscow for the bid. London is the only other city that does not yet have a stadium. For Free Speech Radio News in New York City, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.